This is an ABC podcast.
When you lose a loved one, when you suffer defeat or live through a disaster, what gives you consolation?
I want someone to walk with me and listen to me go on and on and on, the way you do when you're feeling upset about something. And someone with the patience of a saint kind of walks with you and go, yes, 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 yes. It's the supreme test of human solidarity. It's the limit case of what we can do for each other, which is to help each other bear the difficult hours of being a human being. I mean, that's what consolation is about.
I'm Paul Barclay, and this is Big Ideas. For historian and writer Michael Ignatieff, consolation is the most valued gift you can offer someone. It's profoundly personal and relies on people interacting with and committing to each other. So what makes consolation work? It needs to be authentic, but does the conveyed message need to be true?
I'm suggesting you can be consoled by propositions and ideas about which you have doubts. You're consoled by the rhetoric. You're consoled by the hope they contain. You're consoled by the vision that is expressed, and it seems to walk you by the difficult question of truth.
In his latest book on consolation, Michael Ignatieff looks at how great figures in history, art, and religion searched for solace while facing tragedy and crisis. And he shows how we can revive these traditions to face the anguish and uncertainties of our modern days. Michael is speaking with Ruth Penfold Mounts.
Many people in this room and online won't have actually read your book yet. So what's your book about?
It began by accident. I'm not a religious person, but I went to a wonderful weekend at which all the Psalms were performed, 150 of them, by four wonderful choirs in Utrecht in the Netherlands. And I was asked to give a lecture about justice in the Psalms, and like the damn fool that I am, I know nothing about the Psalms and very little about justice, but I thought, hell, why not try? So I spent a summer thinking about the Psalms and got, as one does, entranced by the Psalms, and then they were performed in front of 2,000 people, and there was deep emotion in the room. You could tell that something was happening. The words were projected in Dutch and English over the thing. The choirs were sublime. And I found myself thinking, as a non-religious person, why is it that religious language is so deeply comforting? So that was my starting question. Why is it that we're supposedly in a secular age, God is gone, and yet language which promises us salvation, redemption, forgiveness, God's understanding, remains comforting even if you don't happen to, when pushed, believe the premises. And religion is an absolutely bottomless source of consolation and has been for 2,000 years. Why is it still working? That was my starting question. What is consolation? I thought consolation is simply the process we go through, the language we seek to find to understand moments of failure, loss, tragedy. It's what we do when we face the irremediable in life, stuff you can't fix, stuff you can't change, stuff that just happens, and how you then find the way to go on. I think there's a strong connection between consolation, therefore, and hope, and the process of how you come to accept loss and failure and reversals and find a way to go on. That's how I think of consolation. And then I began following my nose. First I studied the Psalms, and then I went back to the book of Job, and then I went forward to St. Paul's epistles, and then I tracked through right through to the modern day, looking for people who've developed languages and understandings of consolation out of deep personal experience. The one thing about this book is that it's not a series of doctrines of consolation one after another. What it is a series of lives. People who find themselves in a really difficult spot and find a way to go on. That's what this book is about.
Let's pick up a little bit on this, you know, this inspiration through these Psalms. And, you know, you've already said, you know, you're not a particularly religious individual, and yet you've been really sort of inspired by this engagement. Why is it you think that actually religion in an age when we aren't so religious is still so important, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, you folks are lucky enough to have one of the world's greatest examples of the power of faith right in the middle of your city. When I was in York Minster this morning, you got to be made of very strange material indeed if you don't walk into there and feel, you know. I think part of what is consoling about a place like York Minster, just to take that one, is the inspiration you draw from the faith that is instantiated in the building. That is, this has been a center of York's life for, what is it, 700 years, and it has been kept together and maintained and renewed by the community. So it's an expression of the values, the deepest values of the community. It contains the dead of the community, so it honors the dead, and it has these extraordinary windows which point us to another world. And I guess what I feel when I'm in places like that is my little quarrel with God suddenly seems kind of irrelevant. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I just think, so what? Why does it matter that I have a doctrinal difficulty here? This is part of my tradition. I mean, to give you another example, my name is Ignatieff. My father was born in Russia. He died in the Russian Orthodox Church in the faith. And when we buried him in 1989 in August in a little hillside in Quebec, I'm Canadian, we sang the Vyechnaya Pamyat. The Vyechnaya Pamyat is the song you sing at the end of a Russian Orthodox burial. And it says, "Eternal memory grant unto him, O Lord," is what the words mean. Well, what I found interesting about, I found it very comforting to sing that. I didn't sing it well because my Russian isn't so hot. But the idea that my father will be consigned to the eternal memory of God, because that's the only eternal memory on offer. Your memory will fade, my memory will fade, the memory in the room will fade. But the idea that there is an eternal memory in which my father will be remembered is a wonderful thought. It's a wonderful thought whether you believe it is true or not, which raises the very difficult question about the relationship between consolation and truth. And I've been thinking a lot about that recently. Books aren't finished when you finish with them. I'm still kind of puzzling aloud about what these things mean. There are those listening to me now who think, now wait a minute, I cannot be consoled by something I know not to be true. And I'm suggesting you can be consoled by propositions and ideas about which you have doubts. You're consoled by the rhetoric. You're consoled by the hope they contain. You're consoled by the vision that is expressed. And it seems to walk you by the difficult question of truth. There's something queasy going on here. That is, you can be consoled by things whose veracity you doubt. And that's one of the things that makes consolation such an interesting and important subject. Philosophers stay away from it now because they basically, you know, we're in the domain of truth, and so leave that to the shrinks or something.
Yeah, not so comfortable with that necessarily, yes. Yeah. So picking up on what you're saying there, you know, consolation is something that's almost gone a little bit out of fashion. Now, there are a lot of sort of books on death and grieving out there. Mm. And this is offering something just that slightly different. And I think, you know, as I was reading that, that's certainly what I was struck with. And, you know, connecting the idea of consolation with hope. Despite, you know, sufferings and all of the crises that are just riddled through the book, I'm left with hope.
Yes.
And I found that comforting.
Well, consolation is, I think, an old-fashioned word, just start where you started. That's why I wrote the book, to kind of bring it back into the discourse, if I could, and also to make available these wonderful books. Because I think one of the things you want to say about grief and loss and failure is they all leave you feeling terribly alone. And it's a sense of solitude when you lose someone you love, or when you're betrayed by someone you love, or when you fail at something you desperately wanted. You feel alone. You can feel in the depths of your misery, it has never happened to anybody but me. I mean, it's a crazy thought, but that's what you think. And so part of what the book was trying to say is you're not alone. Somewhere, quite close by, as close as your shelf, is someone who's been through pretty much the same thing. And so consolation, part of what is consoling, is to reconnect you to a human tradition that's bigger and older and longer than you, just as it's consoling to go into York Minster because you feel there is a human tradition here much bigger than me, much wiser than me. And it's a bad thing if we lose that constant sense of a human tradition, because the religious tradition is a human tradition. It's all the things we piled up to express our understanding of our place in the universe. So you feel we ought to use it. And the hope that you get from this is a sense of deep connection to other human beings who've been through what you've been through. When we console someone, it's a social, we're together. If I want to comfort you, I don't need to say anything. I can just be there and we'd have a drink or something and you just cry and I just sit there and you know that I'm there. But if I was to console you, I have to say something. I have to say, he was a good man. You were lucky to have known him as long as you did. Or I say, you gave it your damnedest. The fact that you didn't achieve what you wanted is not about you. It was just the competition was really tough this year. Whatever, you know, we all do this all the time. It's one of the most important things that human beings, we console each other. And it's a social relationship when we're trying to help someone else to go on, not to give up. That is what it is to console somebody. And I'm just trying to show there are 3,000 years of this tradition.
Yeah. So with the various sort of cases that you cover in your book, because each chapter is, you know, encountering, like you say, a story, a person or group of persons, and that experience of suffering or loss and the consolation that, that sort of emerges within those sort of stories. Were there any of these stories that you couldn't include in the book? Were there any, if you had more words, if you're allowed to have an extra chapter in your book, who would you include?
That's a wonderful question because it illuminates one thing about the book. I don't want you to think this is a history of consolation. That's way above my pay grade, as we say. Why? Because the sources of consolation are infinite. You know, someone might look at this book and say, you've got all these philosophers and writers and artists in there. Why don't you talk about the consolation of nature, for example? That's missing. Many people find the most consoling thing they could do would be to walk on the Yorkshire moors or the dales or whatever, you know, and there's a deep human comfort and consolation derived from nature. Nature ain't, there are no trees in the book. There's no water in the book. There's no, you know, there's, and so many of you will think, well, these guys are not going to console me because nature isn't there. There would be an absence in the book. Another thing that's missing, it's very weird for a writer to do a critique of his own book. You're all going to go in. Nobody's going to buy the thing. Things are not in the book. If I look at my writing desk, on the left is a silver cigarette case given to my father by one of his superiors in the middle of the Second World War. So it's dated 1944. And I've kept that memento of my father on my desk for 40 years, and it is consoling. It's like my dad is there, right? I'm sure you all in your houses have little objects, totems, little things that are meaningful to you,
that move you, that bring back somebody you've lost and give you some mysterious sense that they're not quite gone. You know, this is how we console ourselves. There's none of that in the book. There's nothing but endless ideas and thoughts and, you know. There is some music in the book. There's a chapter on Mahler. There's painting in the book, a chapter on a wonderful painting by El Greco. There's much that's missing. And if I had to do it again, it'd be 4,000 pages. And it'd be absolutely complete history with nothing left out. But that's not how books get written.
Absolutely. Because I think that's something that's really distinctive sort of in your book, is so much of the consolation is focused on words, which is just what you gave that example before. You know, if you were consoling me, it would be the right words that are being used. And I think that is what I think is really distinctive within the book and offers something really quite original, because it's focusing in on those words. Because very typically, I think, when we think about consoling ourselves, it's often through sort of nature or items or whatever. But here it is that people are actually risking trying to have the right words to reach people.
But the book is also exploring the ironies of that. There's one chapter devoted to Cicero. Cicero was the great Roman orator, great lawyer, the great scourge of the tyrants, and he was the author of very important works of consolation. Consolatio was a genre in classical Roman literature, and people would compose, and Cicero was one of the most primary exemplars of this, would compose letters of consolation, and that they would then be published. Seneca did the same. Cicero did the same. He was a master of the art. And then his own daughter dies. In 45 BC, his daughter, age 28, dies in childbirth. And a man who is the master of the discourse of consolation falls apart. And in his letters that were preserved by his slave and then published, they're wonderful letters, he describes it essentially having a complete nervous, physical, emotional collapse. So that's a terribly interesting moment. Someone who's the master of the language of consolation is inconsolable and finds everything he's written to someone else completely useless. It's a very touching moment. I don't like the magisterial male orator Cicero. I'm much more drawn to the Cicero who's absolutely devastated by the death of his daughter. And he slowly pulls himself back together by resuming his public role. In other words, he doesn't write himself out of this. He finds writing and words useless. That's my point. He resumes his role as Cicero, the scourge of the tyrants threatening the Republic, and dies in that role and is somehow back to himself. And I think that's an important moment in this story, because one of the messages of the book, ironically, since it presents person after person after person trying to write themselves out and think themselves out through to a consoling resolution, they're all deeply aware of how words fail. And it brings home to us this sense in which the process of being consoled is often very unconscious. It doesn't proceed through words. I referred a moment ago to the death of my father. When my father died, I was inconsolable. I'm not inconsolable about my father's death now, but I'd be damned if I could tell you how that happened. It just happened the way it does. You know, you just quietly, you know, beneath consciousness, beneath words, begin to heal. This is not a book designed to cheer you up. It's not a happy talk book. It's designed, in fact, to talk about something that is hard to talk about, which is when words fail us. And consolation takes us to the limits of what language can do. And sometimes language fails us. We can't, our hearts are just broken. I guess one of the things I'm saying is that's one of the things that is most important to respect in other people. We can be inconsolable. Our grief is too much for us. Our sense of love betrayed is too much for us. We just can't go on. And we come out from trying to console somebody slightly irritated. You know, can you just snap out of it? Could you just get over it? But in a way, they're expressing a kind of fierce refusal to be consoled. Because, particularly if they've lost someone they loved, it feels like a betrayal of their love to be consoled, to get over the death of their husband or their wife or their brother or their sister. They don't want to get over the death because that love was the center of their lives. So words fail them. We get inhabited by grief and sorrow. And all of that seems to me to be respected. And thinking about consolation takes you into this murky world where grief has to be respected, suffering has to be respected. There are things we can't get over. There are scars we carry for the rest of our lives. It's part of what makes life such an interesting experience.
I'm going to ask you now for two opposites. Which was your favourite chapter to write, and which was the absolute worst, hardest to write?
Oh, I had people I loved spending time with, just loved. I love Michel de Montaigne. I don't know, many of you may know the 16th century French essayist, but he's just a wise, funny, charming man. And what I came to deeply respect is that he wrote some of the wisest, funniest, and most humane essays ever written by a human being in the middle of plague and civil war. When you resituate these texts in the context, you end up having such admiration for the kind of ways in which he lived through times much more difficult than our own. We're in a bad time at the moment. That's not, you know, let's not sketch it out, but it's a tough time. But many of the people in this book are working in times infinitely more difficult than ours. And I think that gives you a little context and a little different distance. Who did I most like writing about? I have a chapter at the end of the book about Cicely Saunders. I don't know, some of you may know Cicely Saunders. She was a wonderful British woman who was among the most important inventors of the hospice movement. She was a nurse, she was a doctor. She fell in love in serial order with three Polish men, one in 1947, one in the 50s, and one in the 70s and 80s. And from each of these Polish men, she went on a kind of voyage in which she learned how to care for the dying and learned how to create an institution called the hospice, which has provided comfort and a place for consolation for thousands and thousands of people. Maybe some of your loved ones have had hospice care, and it's thanks to people like her. And I had the enormous good fortune in the late 1990s when I lived in London to meet her. And she was absolutely fantastic woman. You know, she was nearly 6 foot. She was ferociously intelligent. She was like my image of a kind of grand county lady, a justice of the peace, you know, with a kind of one of those cut glass English accents of a kind of the kind of ferocious precision to it. But she was one of the kindest, wisest people I've ever met. And meeting her, I think, I loved writing about her. Because she taught me something that, again, we've got ourselves into deep water here, but I've always regarded death and dying as kind of the end, right? It's the end. You don't want it to happen, it happens, it's the end. And there's kind of nothing you can do about it. You just got to do it. But Cicely taught me not merely that you can do it well for yourself, but that you can do it well for others. And that one of the goals that you could have as you die, she taught me, was to take away the fear of dying for those you love around you. And you see this quite frequently, that it is the dying who take away the fear of dying from the living. They say, this isn't so bad, this isn't so hard. And she wanted to create a hospice institution in which, through medication, use of analgesics, you could take away the pain, and so that someone dying could then be able to give a gift to the living, which is to take away their fear. And that's a terribly powerful image of how this could happen. You can only hope you'll be in a position and a place where you can do that. I'd like that for my kids. I'd like them to be there, and I'd like to be able to say to them, it's not so bad. Don't be frightened. That's a good goal to have for death and dying. And I learned that from Sicily. So, you know, I'd have to say that was my favorite person.
That's great. Thank you. As I was reading, actually ending on that chapter, I think it left a real impression. That last chapter is a really powerful one. Because it moves from, you know, how words have been used to try and console in a variety of ways over, you know, different cultures, different centuries, and then it's actually sort of bringing it right up to a much more sort of present day situation. And it's kind of this combination of sort of trying to console through peace and hope. And like you say, it's not just about consoling the individual, it's their dying process is also consoling others.
Yes.
Was there a sort of a case study that, you know, you came across in your writing about that was actually quite sort of surprising when you came across it? Because you hadn't, you know, when you started to sketch out a book, you've kind of got an idea of like, oh yes, I'd probably include this and this. You get a favorite one, you get one that's really hard to write. Yeah. But was there one that you were just like, actually, this was quite surprising to me. I kind of, you know, it's expanded my mind, that sort of thing.
I have a chapter about Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor. The Meditations, this small bundle of fragments that he wrote in Greek, has been read for 2,000 years. It's on every undergraduate philosophy course. It's the classic of Stoicism. And so I thought, well, I better spend some time with Marcus Aurelius. And then, perhaps because I was doing it in Vienna, I noticed that one of these sections of the book, he wrote on the top in Greek script that he was writing it in Carnuntum. Well, Carnuntum is one of the Roman settlements on the Danubian frontier. Vindobana, Carnuntum, it's kind of between Vienna and Bratislava, Carnuntum. And when you know that, you suddenly think about the Meditations a completely different way. He's writing these notes to himself in the middle of a bloody counterinsurgency war against the barbarian tribes on the other side of the Danubian frontier. This is a warrior emperor in his late 50s, ill, exhausted, in the middle of constant bloody warfare. And that, I think, transforms how to read the Meditations. This is not the suave, detached philosopher king expatiating about the futility of human desires. This is a desperately tired old man, warrior emperor, fighting to hold himself together in the face of absolutely terrible scenes of bloody destruction. And it makes it a much more personal document. I mean, if you then think another thought about emperors writing, right? Who can an emperor talk to? It's late at night. You've had a long, hard day being emperor of the known world, right? How do you let your hair down? You know, you can't. You can't trust anybody. You can't talk to anybody. You can't talk to the slaves. there is no one. You're more alone in a certain way than almost anybody in the Roman Empire. And that's why he starts writing the Meditations. He writes them in Greek, so his, you know, so the people around him, most of them who can't read Greek, or many of them can, and he writes them for himself. The only person that the emperor can talk to is the emperor. And that's what the Meditations is all about. That's what makes them such a gripping and moving document. I don't know whether the scholars will, you know, assent to this reading of it. It all deprives from one word in the text, namely, I wrote this in Carnuntum. But hell, that's my line, I'm sticking to it.
You know, this sort of connects to some of the things you were talking about earlier when we were thinking about items like the sort of cigarette case. You know, how objects, when you actually know the story, they gain more significance. And here you've got documents that gain more significance by where they were written because of that sort of broader context. So, you know, I think this is something that's just so important when we're thinking about this term of consolation. It's the stories, it's the people, it's the context. It's more than just written words. It's unpicking that sort of context.
Yeah, somewhere in the book, towards the back end, I say we are not consoled by doctrines. We're not consoled by words. We're consoled by people. The times I've been consoled by particular people who I knew and trusted, who I felt understood me. It's one of the most difficult relations we ever have in life, to console someone who's lost something. It's one of the most important things we have to do. It's the kind of outer limits of human solidarity. And I try in the book to take the doctrines, take the words, take the speeches, and put them back into the lives from which they came. You know, there's a famous book by Boethius, the Roman senator, sentenced to death by a barbarian king in Ravenna in 524 AD. And he writes one of the most famous works of consolation called The Consolation of Philosophy while awaiting execution. And what is The Consolation of Philosophy? It's often been written as the great philosophical treatise on consolation. But recently, I've begun to realize that what it is a desperate man waiting execution alone, creating a persona, imagining a character to keep him company. So he imagines, keeping him company in his cell, this wonderful figure called Lady Philosophy. And he describes Lady Philosophy. He describes her gowns. He describes her dress. He describes her, you know, her hairdo. He describes everything about her. He creates a character to keep him company. And philosophers who talk about this as a set of doctrines are missing the drama of this, which is that a lonely man, frightened and awaiting death, imagines a character to sit with him in a cell. It's a fantastic metaphor for how we console ourselves when we're alone. We kind of split ourselves in two. You know, we have a side of ourselves that says, well, I gave it my very best, you know, I left nothing on the table. And then there's a little doubting voice inside us saying, really? And Boethius recreates that inner dialogue that we have. And in this case, creates someone to keep him company, which is what the human imagination is all about.
The book focuses on words, how words can fail. We've already said that, you know, there's some of those gaps, you know, we don't cover nature and spaces and places. And there's one thing that isn't covered in here that is a good form of consolation, and that's food.
Food.
So if I was going to bring you consolation food, what would I bring you, Michael?
Oh, boy. I had some at lunchtime.
Okay.
I had half a dozen oysters.
Very nice.
And it's a little fancy as consolation food, I grant you. But, oh God. But there again, you know, consolation food, you know, my wife, who's Hungarian, her consolation food is poppy seed pasta. Because her mother used to make poppy seed pasta for her. So any time my wife is in a little, especially when she's scratchy about me, she makes herself some poppy seed pasta. I have a few things my mother used to make. I mean, in other words, it's not the food. It's the connection between the food and your memory, and it brings back people. That's, I think, how it works. I'll take half a dozen oysters anytime.
Brilliant. Okay, that's something for us to bear in mind. I'm going to open up the floor. Has anyone got any questions?
I was wondering whether you'd considered Socrates and the conversation he has when he's sentenced to death with his friends.
Yes. Well, it's the great, it's a little perverse that a book on consolation does not include that. I think you're absolute fair cop, as they say. I think I avoided it because it's been so often done in a way. It's kind of a locus classicus. It's possible I should have included it. I think I didn't because I find it a terrifying conversation, not a consoling one. I mean, this business of Socrates sitting there and saying, well, my hands are getting a little numb, and I've noticed I can't feel my feet. You know, this extraordinary description of the hemlock beginning to work. I mean, it's extremely admirable in one way, and even consoling, because it's a very good example of what I said 20 minutes ago about in relation to Cicely Saunders. He's trying to take the fear of death away from those listening to him. But I find it a scary conversation. Maybe I had the wrong personal reaction. As I think about it, I think had I paid more attention to what Cicely Saunders said about when you die, you can use it to take away the fear of it from others, that may be precisely what Socrates was doing. And if I had understood that moment in that way, I could have written about it.
I'll do a question that's come up on the screen. It came up very early on in our conversation. And she asked, did you consult any non-Western teachings?
Straight answer is no, which is pretty incriminating answer. Not, by the way, because I don't think there are immense sources of consolation in non-Western thought. In fact, one of the really important parts of the history of consolation in the West has been the ways in which slowly, painfully, as we enter a post-imperial age, we have begun to appreciate the extraordinary wisdom of other cultures and traditions that we used to condescend to from an imperial position. We no longer do, to our immense benefit. But that's just a whole other subject, and I thought I was going to stick within traditions that I had some grasp of. So, you know, let's add the things that aren't in the book. There's no nature, there's no things, and there's no Eastern philosophy.
You mentioned at the outset the uneasy relationship between consolation and truth. And I think that was in the context of religious belief and how one might find solace in something which one will never know, but may not objectively not be true. But what about inauthenticity in consolation? So, for example, if I seek to console you, and you talked a lot about the fact that consolation largely comes from personal relationships, if I seek to console you by effectively, perhaps benignly, but nevertheless misleading you, lying to you, how does that fit into the general overview of consolation, do you think?
That's a very important question, and I have been thinking about it because it highlights the extent to which, even in moments of grief and suffering, the authenticity of the words of the person seeking to console us are very much at issue for us. We test and evaluate what people say to us, and phony consolation rings phony to us. It's a complicated process. In the Jewish traditions of Shiva, where you sit Shiva, it's a wonderful tradition. Families sit and they receive friends and neighbors, and they come and they sit, and you either sit silently, which is also a very beautiful thing, but people then speak about the departed person. And sometimes
I've sat in shivas where it's clear that nobody believes a word of what the person is saying about the departed. It's kind of blarney in the Irish sense. But people appreciate it, even though it's blarney, because he's here, and the person has come. He's made the effort, but they kind of discount the content of what the person is saying, because clearly he didn't really know this guy. He's shown up to show respect. So my point about that example is that even in moments of grief and suffering, we're very careful to evaluate the truthfulness or the authenticity of what is being said to us. Truth never disappears from the question of whether we are consoled. And we know that we even have it in the language, there are plenty of false consolations. Consolations that turn out not to be true, consolations that offer us lies, the consolations that offer us illusions. This is where the relation with religion is so complicated, because if you're a non-believer and a priest comes to you and says of your departed, I hope you will meet your departed in heaven, you're entitled to say, if you're a non-believer, I'm sorry, I don't think that's going to happen. That is false consolation to me. If you're a believer, it is true consolation. You believe that you will see your departed in the afterlife. So the question of truth is unavoidable. I guess I'm just agreeing heartily with you about it. And this is important because it also relates to forms of consolation that are not propositional. Music, for example. There's plenty of music that's played at funerals or played at solemn moments that strikes us as sounding a false note. It's not right. And then there's music where you just think, that is absolutely perfect. It is true. It expresses what we feel. And so even in musical experience, we're assessing, your word was authenticity, we're assessing the authenticity and, in a sense, the truthfulness of this expression for us. And that's another thing that makes consolation so interesting to me. It's not the case that when someone comes to us, we're in a kind of state of, you know, suspension of critical reasoning. What is happening precisely is that we want the person consoling us to hit the mark. And when they don't, all we can do is be polite and hope they get out of the room as quickly as possible.
I wondered whether, from your family or personal experience, you have some examples you really want to share with us about consolation and hope. I was thinking of your father, who had not lost his religion, he had not lost his culture or language, but he wasn't in his homeland, he was suddenly stuck in Quebec. And in your case, or maybe, I don't know, maybe your great hope was to become the President of Canada, but you've got to console yourself. You've got stuck in Vienna now. How do you resolve that?
Yeah, it would have been nice to be President of Canada if there was such an office. I would have happily accepted it. One way to answer that, you know, very good question is to say that you don't write a book about consolation unless you've had a number of experiences of A, grief, and B, failure, and you're referring to failure. I did go into politics, and I had an extraordinary experience and became leader of my party and ran to be prime minister, not president, and then got pretty thoroughly defeated in an election in 2011. That must have something to do with the fact that you write a book about consolation. But it can't be the only reason. I mean, it just can't. It'd be kind of ridiculous to write a whole book about Marcus Aurelius and Cicero just because you got thumped in an election in some place like Canada 10 years ago. That just seems a little exaggerated, you know what I mean? No, it's an attempt to think about failure, yes, and it's an attempt to think about grief. I've had no special excessive experience of any of these things. And it's not, I hope you'll be relieved to know, it's not a disguised autobiography. You'll learn little about me, which I hope is a relief to you.
One of the things that you thought you provoked for me was that you were drawing, I think, a distinction between consolation, which you argued very cogently has to come from a human, even if that human is ourselves, and that thinking about nature, pets, food and things might actually be more about comfort, and so you could get yourself off the hook about not having written about them.
Yes, that's a very interesting remark and gives me an excuse for having said nothing about nature and, you know, objects and things. I think what you've helped me to see is just how intrinsically human and necessarily human the relationship of consolation is. You go out to nature and it's comforting, but nature doesn't speak to you. I don't find nature comforting, I find it slightly terrifying. Its beauty is so indifferent, it's so silent, it doesn't speak back. What I want in nature is someone, you know, to put their arm around me. I want someone to walk with me and listen to me go on and on and on, and the way you do when you're feeling upset about something. You go on and on and on, and someone with the patience of a saint kind of walks with you and go, yes, 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 you know, that kind of. So it is, I think you put your finger on it, I think it's the supreme test of human solidarity. It's the limit case of what we can do for each other, which is to help each other bear the difficult hours of being a human being. I mean, that's what consolation is about.
From the recent York Festival of Ideas, that was Ruth Penfold Mounts and Michael Ignatieff. Forgiveness can also bring you solace in dark times, but it's complex and not the same as forgetting. Does forgiveness depend on regret? Does it change in different circumstances? And who is forgiving?
There is real moralising, real ennobling in this idea of interpersonal forgiveness, which essentially has two movements in this way of thinking about it, the post-repentance kind. The first movement is that was terribly wrong, and a mutual acknowledgement of that, followed by a view that together we can somehow get through this and beyond it to some sort of continued relationship, in which the pain and resentment of inflicted suffering is met by regret, efforts at repair and resolve not to repeat. Although that never happens in a perfect way, doesn't mean to say that model doesn't have some good qualities to it. And this isn't the sort of thing that can happen within an individual. It only makes sense in a relationship, even if a very, very tenuous one. But once we recognize that this is a form, but not the only form of interpersonal forgiveness, then it does become easier and more positive to imagine self-forgiveness. So I've been arguing here that there is not one pure, true, or ideal form of forgiveness, rather many forms, all of which have things in common, but none of which should be judged in terms of one of the others. An implication of this in terms of self-forgiveness is that the question is no longer, is self-forgiveness fundamentally a cheap cop-out when interpersonal forgiveness feels too difficult? But can there be some kind of intrapsychic process or dynamic that is reasonably called self-forgiveness in its own right? And one way of framing this is by asking whether we can identify differences between self-acceptance and self-forgiveness. My feeling now is that it can make good sense to talk about self-forgiveness. And a healthy form of self-forgiveness would be something like this. The subject recognizes that what they did was wrong, that it caused suffering and pain, that in doing this I've been disrespectful of others, that I regret this, I seek to put things right, I resolve not to do it again, and this is the next step that this becomes self-forgiveness, I will not punish myself interminably for what I did wrong. And obviously there are circumstances in which that could be an alternative to engaging with the person you've harmed, but there are also circumstances where it is actually impossible to engage with the person you have harmed, for instance, if they are dead, or you don't know who they are, or many kinds of circumstances. I think that forgiveness is the right word to use here, not because the subject splits itself into a good self and a bad self, with a good self forgiving the bad self in the place of the victim or in place of God. It's rather because the intention and trajectory is to move on from a hurtful episode or series of events in such a way that they are acknowledged as wrong, harmful, and inexcusable, but that the badness of them doesn't overdetermine the future. And that, in a way, is one of the ways in which I think it's helpful to think about forgiveness. Forgiveness is something, some exchange or move within or around the self or in a relationship that means that the badness of the past doesn't overdetermine the future. So it is an injection of freedom into the situation. And I suppose that's one of the reasons that I feel that it is really problematic to muddle forgiveness up with moral imperatives. And it's more important to create the space in which people can genuinely forgive. That's not to say that I don't believe that forgiveness should be valued and prized and esteemed in a community. It should be a value, but that's not the same thing as to say it is an imperative. Just because someone has suffered terribly, they now have this further problem, as it were, or conundrum thrust upon them. The point about forgiveness is that bad is overcome by good, that evil and suffering are transcended, and that a new and better future is opened up as people move away from the living hell that can be shaped either by the victim's resentment going toxic and becoming bitterness or hatred, or leading to vengeful plans and behaviours. All that is the way in which you've been hurt and it goes worse for you and for everyone else. Or the living hell of the perpetrator's guilt and shame becoming closed circles of misery for those who sincerely regret their actions and genuinely care about the future of their victims. Forgiveness is that which takes place by whatever means when the claims of both justice and mercy are honoured in the aftermath of culpable, responsible hurt and moral harm. And the natural course of harm leading, natural, I put in inverted commas, the apparently natural course of harm leading to more harm is somehow averted. As I've said, there is no one form of forgiveness. Believe me, when people engage with forgiveness, they are not following a textbook. I mean, this idea that you can tell people how to forgive works in the primary school playground. You know, when someone's hair has been pulled or whatever, now say you're sorry and get on with life. But it doesn't transfer into the really, really difficult situations.
Check out this talk on forgiveness by Stephen Cherry from the Big Ideas Archive. Just search for it on the ABC Listen app. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.